welcome to Sip for Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. We've got a really interesting mix of guests lined up for you in today's episode. We'll be hearing from Tim Reed, Head of Property Services at SIPFA, and Estates and Facilities Manager Matt Isherwood from the Brooke Weston Trust to look at the largely unexplored area of estate management across schools and academies. And ahead of the winners of the 2020 Public Finance Awards being announced next week, we spoke to one of last year's winners. Pauline Moore leads the team at the National Archives that won last year's Finance Team of the Year Award. But first up, we have Andy Piggott and Matt Hedford from SIPFA on evidence-based decision-making in the public sector and SIPFA's new suite of data tools, SIPFA Stats Plus.
Today, we're joined by Matt Hedford and Andy Piggott to talk about SIPFA's new data service, SIPFA Stats Plus. Just to give our listeners some background, Matt is a commercial director here at SIPFA, and Andy, also a SIPFA colleague, heads up the research and analytics team. Matt, to kick off our discussion today, can you give us your thoughts on some of the key data issues that public finance professionals in local government are facing today?
The real big thing is getting access to quality data, which you're able to leverage and then really drive out actual insight. The whole market saying it's really easy, go and find your data, you'll be able to decide what you need to do from that. But it's not that simple, really. One of the biggest challenges everyone's facing at the moment is really this idea around data diversity, the data diversity challenge, which is you might have lots of data, other people might have lots of data, but actually how you pull that together into one place, how you aggregate that, and therefore how you can then search through that data and really get some benefit out of it is really one of the main challenges that people are facing. The world's awash with data. I'm pretty sure that everyone out there will have systems that have grown over the last 20 years. Each system do its own thing, has data to do what it was originally designed to do, but now that data can be repurposed. You can use it for something else. You can pull it out of multiple different systems, pull it together, and what does that tell you? And really, it's one of the things that we're looking at and trying to solve as well, which is, well, actually, how do we aggregate the data that people need to be able to make better decisions as they go forward, or give them insights, at least, that give them a better understanding of the decisions they're taking? Now more than any time in the past, we're in quite a volatile economic and political environment, and really having access to that data quickly and effectively, where it might come from is a big ask at the moment and something that you need to get sorted really off the bat to make sure you can answer the questions that have been asked of you.
Andy, your team has been working on the new data service, SIPFA Stats Plus. Can you tell us a little bit more about the service, your elevator pitch, so to speak?
Yeah, sure. We've recently launched a new cloud-based Power BI platform that's intended in time to host all of our products. Our existing SIPFA Stats is the first product suite to move over to the new platform. And we've launched our enhanced service, as you say, at SIPFA Stats Plus. So it represents the most comprehensive source of financial and non-financial data on local authority frontline services. The migration of SIPFA Stats Plus product suite onto the new platform is happening in stages. It started already, but it's going out over the next 6 months or so. And the team are building dashboards as we speak and demonstrating to a number of the customers that we've got on board already.
Sounds like it's a really big project for the data team at SIPFA. Practically speaking, what's the new user experience going to be like?
Yeah, it is a huge project and it's cloud-based. It'll, of course, host the existing SIPFA Stat data sets, but we've also got some new ones as well that we're excited to roll out in the coming months. Demographics and economy and public health are just a small number of them, but there are a huge list coming up. So really exciting times. The platform's going to give users a completely fresh way to interrogate our data, and it's going to allow them to analyse it in multiple dimensions. The users will no longer have to export and download Excel spreadsheets and then do the analysis on those independently. It's all going to be driven from a centralized product. If I was tasked with producing the PowerPoint slides for seniors at a board meeting, I would want the Power BI system so that I could enrich that PowerPoint deck in a way that wasn't going to take me 5 days to create all the data. It can be done, click, 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 job done. And that imported straight into a PowerPoint slide that's incredibly powerful and very pertinent and particular to the relevant director's conversation.
So I bet actually some of our listeners that are Excel gurus might be a little disappointed to hear that, but ultimately it's designed to be much more user-friendly. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's not all going to go our way. There will still be some Excel spreadsheets. The guys wouldn't do without their Excel spreadsheets. They're experts in that space too. But actually what it does is it enable people to manipulate the data quickly and easily.
And so, Matt, can you tell us a little bit about why SIPFA decided to transform its existing data product, SIPFA Stats Plus? Why the shift to an online digital platform?
Andy, leading off from what Andy's just said, really, people now need to be able to interrogate data themselves to find the answers they're looking for, to be able to look at multiple dimensions, look across multiple data sets. And now more than ever, there's big volumes of data in the world. So I think it's been an ongoing mission over the past 5 to 10 years. Everyone will have heard about big data and how data is going to give you a view to the future and everything else. Well, that doesn't happen if you're working off small data sets. So really, you know, we've got 20 odd years experience here in research analytics. And as Andy and yourself kind of alluded to, you know, that's been done via lots of different methods over the years, pushing out aggregated data via a spreadsheet from different parts of our service. But now we needed to find a different way to provide a visual view, something that people can work with in their day-to-day jobs, something that can be self-service, giving people the tools really to interrogate that data in a more visual way. It just seemed like the right thing to do and what the market was asking for. It also gives us a basis for something to work with in the future. So, you know, our hope is that we transition what we have now, SIP for Stats, into SIP for Stats Plus. And over the coming years, we continue to add new data into that, create new variables and new vectors that can be searched against to really improve that in those data sets. I think we've probably got the widest breadth of data on the market as it stands, but there's no telling where that could end. The introduction of tools such as ClickView and Tableau and Power BI, that's what people are used to now. And we want to be part of that future as well, which is why we've taken the time now to put in time and effort to get this new product out there.
For me, this is all about bringing new customers on board, understanding the benefits of the depth of data that we've got, how we can deliver that in a new and modern way, easily, flexibly, and it doesn't take a whole load of man time to create. Power BI, the system, gives that, and gives that in a way that is so functionally rich. It's incredible. That's why it's going to make a massive difference. And the more people that join the party, the better, because that depth of data gets deeper and deeper the more people that join. We've already got a huge database. We've already got loads and loads of customers across all those verticals, but the more the better.
And so now that we've covered the product, for our listeners that are wanting to find out more about data and data specifically as it relates to the public sector, what are some of the upcoming opportunities for them to get involved?
Best way is actually to attend our breakfast workshop at SIPFA's upcoming conference. It's actually next week. So the sessions on data and decision making will be on at 8:45 a.m. on Tuesday, the 20th of October. It's a fantastic opportunity to join a discussion with experts from across the world of health, police, housing and local government. So really look forward to seeing you there.
And that's about all we have time for today. Thank you both so much for your time.
Yeah, pleasure, Cal.
Thanks, Cal.
Great stuff. Thank you to Matt and Andy for joining us. For more information on SIP for Stats Plus, check out the link in the description below. Next up, we talk Academies Estates with Tim Reed from SIPFA and Matt Isherwood from the Brooke Weston Trust.
Hi, I'm Kate Latimer and I'm here with Tim Reed, Head of Property Advisory Services at SIPFA, and Matt Isherwood, Estate and Facilities Director at the Brooke Weston Trust. Would you mind just starting by telling us a little bit about yourselves and the work you've done in relation to schools and academies?
Hello, Matt Isherwood. I've worked in the academy sector now for just over 10 years. I started off as the project lead in converting mainstream schools into academies. And during that time, I've converted 8 schools across from being a mainstream school into becoming an academy. Often, that is also come alongside either a significant refurbishment package and or a new build.
Tim Reed, Head of Property Advisory Services at SIPFA. My background is in firstly in the military, oddly enough, and then in the last 12 years as a surveyor, first of all in the private sector and then latterly with SIPFA.
So just to kick us off, what exactly are the differences between schools and academies?
I think the main difference is who is the responsible body. In a normal mainstream school, the responsible body is typically the local authority, and that is then delegated down to governing body and the head teacher of the school. Within an academy, the responsible body is the trust, and therefore they are relatively free of local authority intervention. Obviously, there's lots of relationships with the local authority. Not least, the responsibility for school places rests with the local authority, and academies are the schools, are the buildings that provide the accommodation and the educational service. So there is a very close relationship still between an academy and its local authority.
Yeah, and I think broadly, academies have more freedom at the top line, really, than other state schools over finances, the curriculum, teachers' paying conditions. And the key difference is that they're funded directly by central government instead of receiving their funds via the local authority. So they have a lot more autonomy and freedom.
Would you say that the academies having more freedom over their budget and the allocation of those funds is largely a good thing?
Yes, I would say it's largely a good thing. However, with that direct funding becomes responsibility, and therefore it is absolutely imperative that an academy and its trust have strong financial governance procedures in place to ensure that the public's purse is well kept.
Yeah, and they've got to make sure that they've got the right key skills and experience to make sure that they can correctly prioritise allocation of those funds. And from a property perspective, having the right key skills and experience is absolutely vital to ensure that the estate's managed correctly. And I think, you know, we'll probably talk about the estate's aspects later on. But, you know, having those right tools to demonstrate the value that property can bring and things like the savings that you can achieve, having that ability to demonstrate that is important.
What other advantages would you say there was of having this freedom over the budget?
Well, as the responsible body of the particular school, so the MAT, the Multi Academy Trust, or the individual academy trust, by having direct responsibility for the funding and the budget, they get to decide where the priorities are. And to echo what Tim was saying, it's imperative that the right people are in the right position. Got all the right people on the bus sitting in the right seats in order to make the right decisions, both in terms of long-term strategy and immediate actions with budget responsibility.
Again, sort of broadly, you know, they don't have to follow the national curriculum, but they do still have to follow the same rules, and they are still governed by, well, overseen by the Department for Education, who's still responsible. You know, whether they're an academy or a school, they get Ofsted inspected. But they can certainly look to fill in the gaps in areas where there's not enough school places for every child, whether that's primary or secondary, and you can get groups of people coming together who can see an opportunity for a particular deprived area where they feel that there's a case to be made for an academy. So, you know, there are freedoms at that sort of macro level as well, which can fill, say, holes in provision. So it's another, you know, I would see that as an advantage as well.
Yeah. So as you say, I mean, they still have to be held accountable for their achievements and their failings. But there have been a few sort of high profile failures in this system. For example, the collapse of the Wakefield City Academies Trust in 2017. So who is ultimately going to be held accountable for these failings?
Every multi-academy trust, every trust in the country is required to sign up to a funding agreement directly with the Department for Education. And there are a whole raft, as you'd expect, of terms and conditions. So ultimately, it is the Department for Education who will be held accountable for any failed trusts delivering the educational service. Probably worthwhile just mentioning that from a property perspective, the majority of academy buildings are held under leasehold with the local authority on a full repairing lease. So whilst there are freedoms, there are also conditions that come alongside a leaseholder.
Yeah, I think that raises an interesting point as well, because certainly in the work that we do with local authorities where they are liaising with academies, whilst there is a more distant relationship with them, there is still that link, and Matt's quite rightly pointed out one of them there, where there is still effectively a lease, and with any lease there comes obligations in that lease, even if they are very long leases. So from a contractual perspective, you know, there is still some accountability there in that the academy is a tenant and has obligations. But in terms of accountability, as Matt says, ultimately it falls to the DfE. You know, they are accountable for the overall performance of the school system in England. And there are other bodies, and, you know, perhaps we'll talk about other areas of support at a national level and a regional level where academies can go to. But local authorities, I think, do recognise that there is that link where there are leases. I think they also feel from a moral and an ethical perspective that they have a vested interest in making sure that those children that are being placed in academies are being put into an environment that is fit for purpose as well. So, you know, that links to things like statutory compliance and health and safety and things like that, because whilst there's that level of autonomy that exists within the academy sector, it's something that I think the local authorities are very alive to in terms of perceptions and expectations of them as a local authority about what they ought to be doing and ought to be aware of. So I would suggest that there's a fairly strong link, actually, even where they are academies, where, you know, certainly the most proactive and forward-leaning authorities are making sure that the children that are being placed are being placed in the right environment.
So what else does this new system mean for property and asset management specifically?
Well, one of the things that we've seen across the sector is a transition from well-meaning amateurs to a position where their school trusts are making investment to appoint the right people, so people with professional qualifications in the facilities management and property sector. One of the requirements of a multi-academy trust to have an accountant on its books for the financial risk, the risk posed by property and infrastructure function of the multi-academy trust is significant, and we are seeing an increasing number of more qualified, more appropriately qualified and experienced personnel appointed within the system, because ultimately it is the responsible body's duty as the duty holder to ensure that their properties are safe, they are compliant, and they're able to open to the public.
Yeah, I think, you know, since 2010, when the Academies Act came into effect, there's been a real change as academies have sought to make sure that they've got the right people delivering the property infrastructure and estates outputs. And I think what you still have to a very large extent is a really broad spectrum of ability around those roles that you would see in a school that is either a converter academy or a new school. And you get the anecdotal examples of a small rural primary school that has become an academy. Everybody except the school secretary is teaching. So who does the property infrastructure and estates? You know, who manages that all of the buildings are statutory compliant, that the gas boilers fixed or maintained, or the asbestos report is done? It's invariably that secretary who will have no particular property background and training and is in need of significant support. You know, that's the sort of the left hand of the spectrum. And then at the right hand, you've got some huge multi-academy trusts, you know, 160, 170 schools, and they have a completely different need. You know, they've generally got very experienced property hands at various levels, from sort of strategic directors of estates with a strong background, maybe from public sector or elsewhere, with a whole team of health and safety people, facilities managers, caretakers, you know, throughout their organisation within the trust, some of which are sort of held centrally, some of which are on site. And they have a different need altogether. And so I think what academisation has meant has, in some respects, is a recognition that there is a very broad spectrum of need out there, and some of the practical operational level support which would ordinarily have been delivered by local authorities has not been there. And there has been a need to fill that void, which has been happening over the last 10 years. And that's a big part of what Matt with the Trust Network and ourselves with the Education Estates Working Group are doing to try and support DfE, who have recognised, to be fair, that there's that need to provide that support. And informing people that are new to working in the school's estates environment what they need to know as well, and having that ability to go to one place, because that's the other reason that, well, that's one of the other aspects of how the sector has evolved. There is a lot of stuff out there, but in terms of having, you know, a couple of really good central points of contact to go to get that information, you know, that's not existed really. So having somewhere you can go to and get some credible information about what your competencies need to be for the particular role that you've got, and then being signposted to where you can go and get that, whether it's a training course or whether it's a useful document or a tool, you know, what support is out there. You know, that's something that, again, Matt and myself through the Education Estates Working Group are trying to produce, so that there is an authoritative place that people can go to and be told what they ought to know for their role and where they can go to find that training or that support.
What steps do you think need to be taken to address these differences between something which is a private sector business model for a service which is ultimately meant to serve the greater good of the public?
The education landscape has moved on a lot. The operators of multi-academy trusts are far more commercially savvy now in terms of the goods and services that they procure, and the awareness of what they are responsible for is improving weekly. Equally, the commercial sector have become far more attuned and are providing bespoke academy sector services to support, in particular, the property function. 10 years is a relatively short period of time in the whole educational history. Things will evolve, things will improve, certain practices will be dropped in favour of others. And it is a moving feast at the moment in terms of where you can get support and guidance from. And as Tim rightly pointed out, a few years back, there was nothing. Government have put forward strong guidance about strategic matters. And where we are working, both within the Trust Network and with other partners, is to highlight opportunities to get proper advice about the operational day-to-day and the tactical elements of operating a school from a property perspective.
Yeah, I think the other thing I'd add to that is that there is a sort of a move to try and raise the awareness of other aspects of what a school is about, in addition to the provision of education. That's the main output. That's why schools exist. But with this kind of business model that you've got, I think that there is a need to make sure that there is, whether you're in charge of the property and estates function or other aspects of what a school needs to be able to function properly, all aimed at the child at the desk who needs to be educated. I think that previously you will have had the local authority, for instance, with property, who would have made sure that, the property estates function was delivered correctly. And I think one of the things that has needed to happen, and there is some work to do still in this area, I think one of the areas that we certainly want to highlight is around the property aspect, making sure that those people that are responsible but don't do the day-to-day property actually understand the issues at play, the opportunities that exist around, the buildings and the environment, the impact it has on well-being, and the risks that exist as well.
As a headline, it's awareness of what the duty holder is actually responsible for, and awareness of the risk and the risk profile. So, the likelihood of things happening and the consequence of it if it were to go wrong. Once the responsible bodies are aware of that, there is almost an immediate step change in attitude toward the caretaking service, if I can call it that. We've seen immediately, in light of the recent crisis and response of schools with regard to the coronavirus, we changed the name of cleaning to infection control and prevention, and that saw an immediate change of status of those people and their function within the school environment. It is about awareness raising of responsibility. And if people are, people who run schools are intelligent people. They're intelligent people within their sphere of expertise. Where there is danger is when that sphere of expertise doesn't include the property function and they don't have the awareness of that area or the opportunity to delegate to appropriately qualified and experienced people.
You've been listening to SIPFA Speaks, and we hope you've been enjoying the episode so far. Now, as many of you know, our annual conference, Public Finance Live, is coming up next week. This is the first all-virtual conference SIPFA has ever done, and we've got an incredible set of speakers lined up to explore the road to recovery from COVID-19. We'll be hearing from former Chancellor Philip Hammond, Chief Data Reporter for the Financial Times, John Byrne Murdoch, organisational psychologist and ex-NBA player John Amici, Sir Tony Redmond. It really does cover the entire gamut of public services. There is still time to register, details are in the description. But not only will we be hearing from some truly fascinating individuals, we'll be celebrating the public finance profession through the announcement of this year's Public Finance Awards. We had some really brilliant entries this year, and with many categories, a super, super tough call. Ahead of this, I spoke to one of last year's winners and found out more about the project that won the Finance Team of the Year Award for the National Archives Finance Team.
I'm here with Pauline Moore from the National Archives. How are you, Pauline?
I'm good today, thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us today. Could you tell our listeners a little bit more about you, your position, and the archives for those who might not know that much about them?
Sure, yeah. I started off in public finance about 18 years ago. I was a SIPFA trainee for a borough council. I then progressed and worked for a shire county. And then about 5 years ago, I moved into central government, joined the National Archives. And we are based out in Kew. We've got about 500 staff, about 50 million turnover. And we are the custodian of one of the world's most significant archival collections. So we've got everything from the Doomsday Book to cabinet papers from John Major's premiership. It's about 11 million records, paper, parchments, photographs, and then of course our electronic records and websites.
Well, that sounds fascinating. I'm a little bit of an archives nerd myself. On my grad scheme, I spent a bit of time in the Wessex Film and Sound Archive. Quite interesting stuff. However, the main reason we've got you on today, Pauline was a member of the team at the Public Finance Awards last year, where the National Archives won our Finance Team of the Year award. So at the time you won your award, your team were operating at 65% of the resource that they'd had 2 years prior. So how has austerity impacted on the work that you guys do?
I joined the archives in 2015, and very soon after that the spending review hit. And to be fair, we came out relatively well. We secured flat cash and we thought, okay, this is something we can manage. But 2 years in, we had a business rate revaluation and our bill doubled. So that's now absorbing about 12% of our voted funding. So we found ways to manage it, but we realised that it would mean if we were to continue doing what we'd always done, we would have nothing left to grow and invest in our priority areas. So what we needed to do was reshape the way we were structured, and this happened through back-to-back voluntary exit campaigns. So 10% of our workforce basically left. So I think the key thing was that we were able to show leadership within our team, not only in our support of the process, but you know, when vacancies are rose, we didn't just immediately backfill, go straight to market. We took a step back, reflected on what we needed, considered how we might do things differently, because we couldn't ask the business to find savings if we weren't prepared to do it ourselves. So I think personally that was the key thing for us, and that's, we were right in the middle of that when we submitted the award, hence the 65% sort of staff in post.
So pretty tough conditions all round, but obviously, as you say, your team won that Finance Team of the Year award in 2019. The team are clearly doing brilliant work. So can you tell me a bit about the project that secured the win for you?
Yeah, it was, I think the thing is, I mean, I should say we are quite a small team. Even at full strength, there's probably about 13 of us. And I think those shortages really, people pulled together, and it really had a sense of working together and pulling together in adverse times. So when it came to the submission of the award, it was actually very, very easy to write it, because there were so many examples of things that I felt so proud that the team had done. I think the two main headlines were that we introduced IFRS 15 a year early. So we were in the middle of a major commercial contract that was spanning across a number of years. It fell in such a way that had we adopted it alongside everybody else, it would have massively skewed the income that we recognised. And so in the best interest of the organisation, we decided to adopt it early. And I have to say, this was purely my colleagues who championed this through. Had I realised at the time what it was actually going to entail and how brave it was, I think I probably would have wussed out. We had to get NAO approval. We had to get a special Treasury direction. I mean, like I say, we are quite small in terms of government as a whole, and yet we kind of championed this. A year after completion, we were writing the disclosures from scratch as to what we thought we needed to put in the account. So that was quite major. It felt like we were punching above our weight in doing that. And then at the same time, that was kind of on the financial accounting side, on the management accounting side, we upgraded the system. And I guess this is something that accountants do fairly regularly, but I guess we are, like I say, a small team. Our finance system is not one of these sophisticated software tools. It is quite basic, and we had to upgrade. And so we did it without any extra resource. We just pulled it in, perhaps took a little bit longer than some other projects might have done, but everybody, I think, gained a bit more from it. They learnt more about how it works, and we use it as an opportunity to redo all of our reporting, which meant that the end users in the business had much better management information within the limitations of the system. So I think there were two big headlines that we were able to put down on the submission.
So I think what comes out of that for me is how great it is to have when you've got such a small team like that, the feeling of everybody pulling together and producing something really great.
Yeah, and in a strange way, like I say, when I sat down to write the bid, I didn't think necessarily, oh, we're going to win this award, but I just thought, I want to document everything we've achieved. Well, for two reasons, really, but to pick up on your point, you know, that one of the reasons was for me as head of finance to say thank you to the team in a very formal and public sort of way, because you try to give feedback throughout the day or throughout the year, but sometimes it's important to do that a little bit extra, I think. And so I wanted them to see how proud I was of everything that they'd done. And so yeah, so that was one of the primary reasons for doing the submission.
Well, thinking whether you're going to win or not, it must have been, the winning the award itself must have been quite a nice morale booster for everybody.
It absolutely was. Yeah, we didn't actually expect to get shortlisted, and I kind of kept it as a secret from them. them. So they only found out about it after we'd been shortlisted. So that in itself was just lovely to be able to tell them. And that was the first time that they read the submission. And like I said, the closing statement being, it's a thank you to the team. And then on the night, yes, we went in, and you can imagine there was a degree of nerves, and we were trying to work out the strategy, if you like. And so our table happened to be right at the back of the room. We concluded, well, that means that of course we can't possibly win, because they must put all of the winners up near the stage because it's for ease of access. So it was that strange feeling where we were very relaxed after that point, because we thought, it's okay, we can just enjoy the evening. And we were on a shared table with some people from the Northwest NHS, and so we made some great friends. And then it came round and we won, and it was such a shock. It really brought the team together. It was lovely to spend time in that environment.
How was the night for them then? Very celebratory?
It was, yeah. You see people every day in the office in the business suits with their heads down at a computer, and it is just always so important to be able to step away from that, put on a posh frock and have a few drinks and really, you know, chat as people. That in itself was just really a nice experience.
So how is the work that was involved in the kind of your awards submission, how has it changed things into the future? Is it still affecting what you're doing now?
I think it is, but primarily from a psychological point of view, if you like, in that I think it gave the team belief, I think it gave them a sense of pride, and I think within the organisation, the perception of finance clearly improved. You know, it was lovely. We were featured all over our intranet page the next day, and we've got the award in a glass cabinet in reception. Sort of thing, because I mean, I guess in a sense finance is always like the referee in a football match, in that if you do your job absolutely brilliantly, nobody notices. You know, in a sense it's our job to make sure that everything's on track, that everything's balanced, that resources are maximized, that the underspend is minimal, that the audit is quiet. And it's only if things go wrong that you think, oh crikey, we could have done better there. So I think for me it was quite important to bring home to the organization, actually we are doing a really good job here. So on those two perception levels of the team and of the organization, they were to me the big things that that changed.
Oh, I really do like that referee analogy. I might have to steal that one.
Please do.
But yeah, I mean, finance is one of those professions in general that by and large 90% of the day job is steadying the boat, making sure everything's going as it should, and therefore no one calls finance until they've got a problem.
Absolutely, yeah. And then similarly as well, I mean, you know, this morning I've been in a meeting to look at potentially a new software system, combined finance and HR system. Nobody is going to volunteer resources or make savings to allow us to do that, because back office functions aren't sexy, that, you know, that they the benefits of them aren't as obvious. And I think by raising the profile of the team and what we can do for the organisation, you know, it helps with your reputation internally.
Fab. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Pauline. Are you going to be joining us at this year's Public Finance Awards?
We haven't entered this year, but we may well do in the future. We've got a few projects to be working on, and that hopefully will keep us motivated, that will keep the momentum going. Like I said, I mentioned the potential of the new system, so I can see us putting in an application in the future.
Awesome. Well, we very much look forward to welcoming you back, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks.
With Pauline Moore from the National Archives. We really do love the opportunity that the Public Finance Awards offer to celebrate the unsung heroes of the public finance profession. We'll be announcing this year's winners on Twitter, so make sure you're following both SIPFA and Public Finance when we announce the winners next week. That's about all we've got time for today, so thank you to everyone who joined us for today's completely packed episode, and we will see you again next time.